Ms. Sullivan.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Mr. Jimenez was convicted twice based on the testimony of four eyewitnesses to the murder of Eric Morrow. The criminal jury heard testimony about many of the features of the investigation that Mr. Jimenez now asserts as Brady violations. The judgment in this case cannot stand because the trial was fundamentally unfair from literally beginning to end. Jury selection was tainted by the clearly erroneous Batson ruling and forfeiture, the evidence by substantial improper expert testimony that virtually every aspect of the investigation was unreasonable, and the verdict itself by Mr. Jimenez's reliance on six new Brady theories during closing argument. Mr. Jimenez seeks to avoid these serious prejudicial errors by asserting that the post-verdict settlement with Detective Bogucki makes the appeal futile. I will begin by briefly addressing the settlement and then turn to the Batson rulings and the expert testimony. We will rest on our briefs for our submission that Mr. Jimenez's failure to give notice of all of his Brady theories requires judgment for the defendants on the new theories, and that his failure to introduce the criminal transcripts requires judgment on the entire Brady claim.
On that last point, is it your – I know you don't want to talk about it, but I'd like to understand whether your position is that both of the criminal trial transcripts had to be read to the jury.
There might have been several ways of putting that evidence in front of the jury, but we do rely on the Eggers case.
Was the defendant prevented from putting any part of the record in front of the jury?
Yes, Your Honor. We did move to admit certain portions, and the district court rejected that. We cite that in our brief. I'll find the citation for you. But, of course, it's not our burden to prove the plaintiff's case. Our position is that under Eggers, under Ross, other cases from this court, the standard for materiality is to be judged on the basis of the entire record.
And it must be read to the jury?
As I say.
Or else you just dump it in their laps and let them take it back to the jury room. Which
there,
is it?
There
or
might
something
have,
else?
There might have been, it could have been read, perhaps it could have been submitted, perhaps portions could have been stipulated to. But that was not done here. Our position was, and Mr. Jimenez was on notice. At the transcript, the district court tells him, page 1911, the district court tells him the transcripts are essential to your case. So there should have been no surprise here. It comes from Eggers.
I'm trying to figure out how to try one of these cases without imposing cruel and unusual punishment on the jury.
Well, it's something the district courts do all the time in habeas cases. Those are judged on the basis of the entire record.
In habeas cases.
True, Your Honor. My point is simply that the entire record it has to be looked at to determine materiality.
So the jury has to listen to the whole thing.
The jury has to listen. Portions could be stipulated if there is an agreement on both sides, but none was sought here. Mr. Jimenez's position was those transcripts are not coming in. Even the limited portions that we wanted in, he resisted. So he was on notice. The transcripts are essential. He should have been on notice from Eggers. He was on notice from the district court in this case as well. He made a choice to keep those transcripts out, to keep out any...
No, he didn't make the choice to keep them out. The city could have put them in. He made a choice not to put them in himself.
Correct, Your Honor. He did make that choice, and now, because he is the plaintiff, our position is that he failed to prove that claim, and the Brady claim. And the difference is actually extremely important here, because much of the information, many of the Brady theories... that Mr. Jimenez's counsel relied on in his closing argument are covered in those transcripts. And so it would have been patently clear to the jury that those theories were not unknown, that evidence was not unknown to the jury in the criminal cases. Just as examples, that Phil did not want to be a witness, that Sean had been arrested, that Bogucki's notes were a composite of the two interviews, all of that came out in the criminal transcripts. We did submit them as a supplemental appendix, just to support our argument on that basis. But turning to the to the agreement. After hearing the jury come in with a compensable damages verdict of $25 million, Detective Bogucki agreed to give the testimony necessary for Mr. Jimenez to waive his punitive damages claim. For at least two reasons, that testimony does not affect the issues we present on appeal. First, in the course of presenting that agreement to the district court, counsel for both parties envisioned that there would be an appeal. Indeed, Mr. Jimenez's counsel even gave as an example that there might be a successful appeal on Batson. So the agreement itself did not do what he now says it does, and he should not be allowed to induce an agreement based on representations that the agreement would not be used until retrial at the earliest, and then say it bars the appeal. And second, the city was not a party to that agreement. Detective Bogucki,
I'm puzzled by your position. Why aren't you embracing their argument and saying that as a matter of state law, this relieves the city of its obligation to indemnify?
We might get to that, Your Honor, but for the moment, both appellants before the court are in agreement that the agreement that between Detective Bogucki and Mr. Jimenez is invalid to bind even Detective Bogucki to it, because he's playing with our money. And under Illinois law, that is
But as you read this agreement, it's an agreement by the detective to sell out the city on a retrial. And why, as a matter of state law, are you not saying that relieves us of our obligation to indemnify? And so all that should happen on this appeal is to affirm the judgment with respect to the detective and vacate it with respect to the city.
The court could do that, of course, but
asking about what we could do. I'm asking why you're not arguing this, because you haven't argued it.
We have not argued that, Your Honor, because we don't think we're at that point yet. We think that by the plain terms of the agreement, it says we will not use this until retrial. We are not at retrial. It cannot be used. We do make a separate argument that at the retrial it will run into Rule 408, but for present purposes, our position is the agreement does not say, and under Illinois law cannot be read, to bind even Detective Bogucki, much less bind the city, because he's playing with our money. And we cite the Green case.
That's where you lose me. Under Illinois law, Bogucki can do whatever he wants. It just has a consequence. The consequence is it relieves the indemnitor.
Correct.
But your argument here is that you can't read the agreement to be Bogucki giving away the case.
As I stand here right now,
you can read the agreement that way. It just has a consequence. Now, the consequence turns out to be extraordinarily favorable to your client and extraordinarily hurtful to the plaintiff.
Right.
I just wonder why you're not arguing it.
As I stand here now, Your Honor, I do have two clients. I do represent the city and Detective Bogucki.
Maybe he needed separate counsel as soon as this happened.
Well, his counsel and his counsel only was present when this agreement was reached, and we do highlight that in our brief. We do also highlight that it was collusive for that reason and coercive. But for present purposes, our position is that it does not bar this appeal. We are in agreement on that. I have no conflict as I stand here. What might happen down the line if this court reads the settlement agreement in a way that would put it outside the plain terms of the agreement and outside the limits of Illinois law, we would have other remedies, but we do not believe we're at that stage now. I would like to turn just very briefly to the Batson
issues. You're under rebuttal time, you know.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Just very briefly on the Batson issues. The district court erroneously sustained Mr. Jimenez's Batson objection to the peremptory challenge to Juror SM. Defense counsel adequately identified a recent neutral reason to strike her. Her great-nephew had been convicted of murder and recently released after 14 years, as well as a race-neutral reason to strike her and not Juror EC, who had served 2.5 years in Iowa 40 years ago on a marijuana charge. That made these jurors different. It was a reasonable trial strategy to think that they were, and the Batson ruling was in error.
Compounding. If the district judge had rejected the Batson challenge, that probably would not have been an error.
That is correct.
What we've got is a straight credibility finding on the part of the district judge.
It's not the credibility of defense counsel, however, Your Honor.
Oh, it is.
Yes.
That's exactly.
The judge found that defense counsel was lying about his motive.
It's a tough way to start a trial, but that's the finding that has to be made and that was made here. So why is that clearly erroneous? And why isn't it harmless?
It's clearly erroneous because it was a matter of reasonable trial strategy to think that these people were different, and it was not harmless. We do argue that the standard for review on that should not look to whether, whether it is reversible should not turn on whether the appellant can show that it was harmless. It's never going to be possible to show that. The Harbin case and decisions from 12 states that we cite in our reply brief explain why that standard can't apply. We think the standard should be the same for whether a Batson.
Is it your argument that any biased juror was seated?
It is not, Your Honor, but this is about a peremptory challenge.
We understand that, but of course the whole point of Martinez-Salazar was to reject the argument that when you can't show harm, we have to reverse automatically.
Martinez-Salazar came up on different facts, Your Honor. Martinez-Salazar involved a use of a peremptory challenge to replace a challenge for cause.
It can be distinguished on its facts, but the Supreme Court doesn't decide cases good for this day and train only.
Correct.
They established a principle.
The principle does not reach this case, Your Honor. To our knowledge and to for anything cited in Mr. Jimenez's brief, there is no case that either party has found with an erroneous Batson ruling and a pile-on forfeiture after that. And I will save the remain. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
I would save the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Certainly, counsel. Mr. Bowman.
Good morning, Your Honor. Let me begin with the points about the transcript. First and foremost, the argument gets phrased, failed to prove a Brady violation. It is inescapably a sufficiency of the evidence argument. And what is manifestly clear is that in this case, there was no 50A motion. Any arguments about the sufficiency of the evidence, including that plaintiff failed to sustain his burden because he didn't put in the trial transcript, are certainly waived. But to be very clear, any party who wanted to examine any witness with respect to anything that any witness had said at either of the criminal trials was entitled to do that without restriction, save for one technical exception that had to do with a witness who didn't come to the trial to testify. To the extent the witnesses were there, they could be and frequently were asked any number of questions about how they had testified at the criminal trial.
Is that one exception the one that defense refers to in its brief at the end
yes,
of the trial?
Yes, that's correct.
It was an availability and hearsay issue?
It is actually a technical exception. The portion of the transcript was not in the pretrial order.
Okay.
And because it wasn't in the pretrial order, the defense was not permitted to use it as a freestanding exhibit. But to the extent anybody wanted to read from it at trial, that was not ever a subject of restriction. Now, to come next to the question about the judicial admission and the stipulation, to be very clear, in this case, the city, as it frequently does, stipulated that it would pay any judgment that was rendered against the defendant detective in the trial. And consequently, when the judgment was entered, there was a motion to amend the judgment so as to substitute the city. There was no objection to that. The judgment now is against the city. There is no basis for any argument to be made at this point. It's certainly not raised in the briefs.
Well, certainly not raised in the briefs, but the basis for the argument is that Bogacki has now joined sides with the plaintiff. And that does seem pretty problematic as a matter of Illinois law.
Well,
indeed, one wonders whether we've got a case or controversy at this point.
Well, it's very clear that the effect of the stipulation is to make a retrial something that doesn't seem to have any.
That's why I ask about the case or controversy. Now, of course, if the upshot of this agreement by Bokaki is to relieve the city of its obligation to indemnify, we certainly have a controversy on appeal, because the city is asking to get out from under a $25 million judgment and is entitled to.
But again, that's not a controversy that's been presented to the court. The city moved in pursuant to the stipulation. It bound itself by the judgment.
Was that after Bogucki's post-verdict testimony?
Yes, Your Honor, it was. Okay. And I'm sorry I interrupted you.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I interrupted him, but I apologize.
No problem.
We do that from time to time.
Yeah. In any event, whatever contentions might be made about this under state law are not before you. And the
Discuss with your client the fact that this curious agreement with Bogucki might cost him $25 million?
It was not and is not our belief that it does, Your Honor.
I didn't ask that question.
Well,
you can say, I plead the attorney-client privilege. I don't have to tell you what I discussed with my client.
And that was going to be what I was going to say.
If what's going on in this case is that he gets the emotional satisfaction of having Bogucki fall on his sword at the expense of $25 million, he may regret it.
Your Honor, what is clear is that there is a $25 million judgment against the city, which the city obligated itself to pay, not just as a matter of state statute, but also as a stipulated matter in this case. That judgment is the result of a trial that was fair from start to finish. The extraordinary thing about this record is the paucity of objections. The effect of that is that the record is the record before this court is one in which it virtually wholesale the arguments that are presented here have been waived. Let me start with the jury selection point that was also the subject of discussion on the other side of the argument. This jury was comprised of individuals who, none of whom were challengeable for cause. There was no juror who sat on this jury who was other than impartial in the eyes of the law. There was, therefore, if there was any error in the arguable over-application of Batson, that error is clearly harmless. It is harmless under Illinois versus Rivera. It is harmless under United States versus Patterson. It is harmless under Martinez-Salazar. The authority is overwhelming and clear that so long as a jury is comprised of participants who are not challengeable for cause, any error is harmless. The city cannot overcome that fundamental hurdle. The next problem with the city's position on this argument is that to the extent they complain, as counsel suggested, about some add-on forfeiture, there was no objection to the process of jury selection. There was a debate about the Batson at the Batson hearing as to whether the Batson ruling, Batson findings were correct, but beyond that, there was no objection whatsoever.
I don't understand your reference to objection. Immediately after ruling on the Batson contention, the district judge said, and I'm not going to give you another. Now, if the city had complained, that complaint would have been called not an objection, but an exception. Once the judge has ruled, the complaint, remonstrating with the judge, is not an objection any longer. It's an exception. And the rule is pretty clear, I think, that exceptions are never necessary.
But then following that juncture, the jury was impaneled. No objection was registered on the record at that point. There was never any complaint that the jury selection had compromised the ability to exercise the statutory strikes.
Well, that was conceded. Ms. Solomon conceded on her feet that there's no contention that any partial or biased juror was seated.
Right.
Your argument on harmlessness is a lot stronger than your argument on waiver.
I take the point.
To be blunt.
I take the point. And let me move then to the third hurdle, which is that there is a highly deferential standard of review. We can engage in a debate this morning about whether the district court was correct in its credibility finding. And the very fact that we can engage in that debate indicates that there is a basis in the record for the district court's finding of fact. That finding of fact is not clearly erroneous. As you indicated, Judge Hamilton, if it had gone on the flip side, we could have the same debate, and it probably wouldn't change the outcome. This is committed to the discretion of the district court as it views the unfolding events and the credibility of the individuals, the counsel, and the jurors involved. And what happened here was obviously supported by the record and is fairly debatable, and therefore is beyond correction in this court, even assuming it were incorrect, which we hardly concede and do not concede. As to the point about the loss, strike that. As to the point about the absence of a makeup, to be very clear, there were three strikes awarded to each side at the beginning of the selection process. Each side exercised three strikes. One of the strikes that was exercised by Bogecki was deemed to have been exercised in a discriminatory manner. And the court concluded that, and it moved on. It did not permit an additional strike to make up for the one that had been wasted through misuse. There is no case suggesting that that is an abuse of discretion. It was not an abuse of discretion.
The is there a case saying it's okay?
Yes. There are a couple of cases in the criminal context which are cited in the briefs in which the courts have actually passed on this question of whether it's appropriate to do what the district court did in this case and have said yes. United States versus Walker is one of them. It's cited in the briefs. But the truth of this is that no court has ever been troubled by this. It is very clear under Batson that the remedial process is entrusted to the discretion of the district court, and it's very clear under the cases that there are a variety of methods that the district court can employ in order to address a Batson problem when he finds one, or she does. And that's all that happened here. Absolutely nothing in the approach that the district court took was abusive of discretion. What the district court concluded later, after the trial, the first time that this was presented for his consideration, was to say that if the offending party were offered an additional strike to make up, that that would incentivize free shots at discrimination. If the individual weren't detected discriminating, then he would get away with it, and if he were detected, it'd be no harm because he could strike again. So this Batson argument is flawed on a number of levels, on harmlessness, the absence of ejection, not our best argument, but also as well because of the extreme deference to the district court in this kind of circumstance and the fact that the record amply supports what the district court did in this case. The remaining issues are inconsequential. There is a discussion in the briefs about McCrary's testimony, the expert witness's testimony. Again, no objection whatsoever. A point that was not even raised in the post-trial motion. It is presented for the first time as a result of the invention of the appellate lawyers after the fact. McCrary provided garden variety expert testimony, didn't stray into any matters that
well, the,
would be...
the one time he did start to stray, the district judge reined him in over an in sustaining an
objection.
Yes, that's right.
The only objection of a substantive nature that was made during McCrary's testimony was an objection that was sustained. And in every other respect, this was garden variety testimony about how trained police officers engage in the process of investigation.
Why was this evidence relevant? This was a constitutional claim, as I understood it, not a theory that any time best practices aren't used, there should be damages awarded.
There was also, Your Honor, a state law malicious prosecution claim that was tried simultaneously in which the issue was malice.
Yeah, malicious prosecution is different from not using best practices in an investigation.
But the repeated unjustified straying from best practices can be taken as evidence of malice. It is one good way to show that the mental state of the individuals involved was widely astray.
Would you agree, Mr. Bowman, that some of this has been presented in terms of allowing an expert to testify on the ultimate issue the jury would have to decide? That's really not a problem, but as I understood it, the issue the jury had to decide here was whether the officer or the detective engaged in deliberate concealment of exculpatory evidence, right? I mean, that's what you had to prove.
That was the that's.
And I understood the theory of McCrary's testimony to be, look, you're hearing this, ladies and gentlemen, you're hearing this story about how Bogucki claims he did the investigation. It's not credible because it's so far off of what police officers are trained to do. It's not unlike arguments that are used in tax cases to say the defendant's belief that he wasn't required to pay taxes is so utterly unreasonable that you should treat it as dishonest.
Right. As I say, there are two issues. There's the malicious prosecution issue, and then there is the Brady concealment
issue.
But
both require deliberate misconduct.
Both require a mental state of deliberate violation of the plaintiff's rights. And I see that my time is up. If I could just finish that one.
You can always answer the question that the judge asks.
So far you're still being responsive.
I'm in peril. I think I'd best stop without.
You don't want to be judicially declared to have lapsed into non-responsiveness.
That happens a lot in this room, however.
Thank you, Mr. Bowman.
Yes, sir.
Thanks. Anything further, Ms. Solomon?
On the agreement, the Monell stipulation, which Mr. Bowman mentions, it is at Record 199-1, Exhibit A, page 2, paragraph 5, and I'll quote, the city retains the right to appeal. So that's it for the agreement. On the Batson issues, in addition to the reason that Chief Judge Easterbrook gave for why it was preserved, the district court also decided both the ruling on the merits ruling and the forfeiture in the post-trial motion. So that is preserved for review. And to the extent that the district courts, that this court reads the district court's ruling on the Batson challenge by defense counsel, the Batson objection by defense counsel, to be a credibility determination, it is an abuse of discretion because it relies on improper considerations. It relies on the idea that intuition can never play a role. It cites the Broomfield case, the Fourth Amendment case. Mr. Menes does not even defend that ruling. So that is an abuse of discretion. It also applies an unconstitutional presumption that an African-American juror cannot be struck before a similarly situated white juror. It misstated the nature of the objections by defense counsel and a host of other problems that we describe in our brief. And so even as a credibility ruling, we do say that it is an abuse of discretion. And I want to emphasize, the peremptories, of course, are in addition to challenges for cause. That is why counsel's statement that the authority here is overwhelming is actually completely untrue. There are a handful of cases dealing with this exact situation. We commend the Maloney case to the court. Counsel said there is no case that says forfeiture is no good. That's exactly the holding of Maloney.
Maloney yes, was, the circumstances there were quite different.
The Eighth Circuit
in the Abishail case seemed to be, at least to me, directly on point. Unless there's
except there's no forfeiture in that case. Otherwise, it is on point. There are two cases that actually involve forfeiture. One is the Walker case, which involved a venire drawn from far away and difficulties, and it may not even be correctly decided, but in any event, it is very different from this case. And the other is the Ailman case. It's an unpublished decision, and it involved, quote, a suspicious pattern of strikes. There is simply no case that involves one Batson objection and a forfeiture. And the forfeiture, of course, was an abuse of discretion if for no other reason than the district court did not exercise its discretion. He didn't give a reason. He said, that's Batson, you forfeited it, I'm done. And that is not the exercise of discretion. At a minimum, the holding of Maloney reaches that much because it was conceded that the reason the district court forfeited all the peremptories in that case was because of the pattern of Batson violations. And Maloney, nonetheless, on mandamus holds that forfeiture is an inappropriate remedy just for that. Mm-hmm. We would ask the judgment be reversed.
Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement. We'll hear